The Apostle John was a relatively simple man, a fisherman by trade. He was not well educated. When he wrote with short sentences, simple grammar, and a relatively uncomplex vocabulary. But simple though he was, John was not ignorant. The concepts with which he dealt were very profound. And he knew how to use subtle literary devices to impress upon his readers the pathos of a particular moment. Nowhere is that done more skillfully than in John chapter 13, where immediately after Judas is identified as the one who would betray his Lord, and immediately before the Apostle Peter denies three times that he even knows Jesus, John writes, "And it was night." Sure, it was night because it was late in the evening when the Last Supper took place. But it was night in a spiritual sense, even greater. It is always night when someone abandons Christ for his own purposes. It is always night when Satan takes control of a person's life. It is always night when someone turns his back on a friend. In John chapter 13 here, there are two tragic characters, Judas and Peter. And in both of them we see darkness, the darkness of betrayal and the darkness of denial. Strangely, right in between these two accounts, we find Jesus speaking about love as he delivers his new commandment. It's like a powerful beacon in a black cave. This new commandment cuts through the darkness of betrayal and the darkness of denial. And it gives us hope for true discipleship and for faithful service. Let's begin with the darkness of betrayal. The entire story of Judas is a real anomaly. How does one explain or even understand the dastardly deed that this man committed? William Hazlitt wrote an essay entitled "Persons One Would Wish to Have Seen," and Judas Iscariot is one of the characters that he focuses upon. He said, I fain would see the face of him who, having dipped his hand in the same dish with the Son of Man, could afterwards betray him. I have no conception of such a thing. Strangely, though, it was no surprise to Jesus, for he revealed in advance the betrayal of Judas. All through this 13th chapter, in verse 2, in verse 18, verse 21, and verse 26, Jesus is revealed to be aware in advance of Judas's action. He knows that the cost of redeeming mankind is going to be betrayal by a close associate, and he is willing to pay that price. He reveals the event in advance because he doesn't want his disciples to think that he is a victim of circumstances. In addition, he wants to strengthen their faith. Look at verse 19. "I am telling you now before it happens, so that when it does happen, you will believe that I am the Messiah." Jesus knows about Judas's betrayal in advance, not only because Jesus is God, but because Jesus knows the Old Testament. And the Old Testament predicted that this would happen. In Psalm 41:9, quoted here in verse 18, it says, "This is to fulfill the scriptures. He who shares my bread has lifted up his heel against me." In biblical times, accepting an invitation to have dinner with someone signified a close friendship and companionship. And to turn against that person who invited you to a meal would have been viewed as a dastardly deed. In Psalm 41, David is speaking of Ahithophel, who joined a coup d'etat against David. And when it did not succeed, Ahithophel went out and hanged himself. Now, while David had in mind Ahithophel, God had in mind a prophetic event that would happen to Messiah himself. The fact that Ahithophel and Judas are the only two people in all of Scripture said to have hanged themselves indicates that this connection is certainly no accident. By the way, if you knew in advance that your best friend or one of your best friends would turn against you, how would that affect your attitude toward that person? Think about it a moment. The world today has a philosophy that goes something like this. Do it to him before he has a chance to do it to you. And I suspect that many of us would take that approach if we knew for sure that a close friend would betray us. Psalm 55, verses 12 to 14. Talk about the terrible wound that comes when a friend betrays us. Listen to these verses. If an enemy were insulting me, I could endure it. If a foe were raising himself against me, I could hide from him. But it is you, a man like myself, my companion, my close friend, with whom I once enjoyed sweet fellowship as we walked with the throng at the house of God. What incredible grief comes to us when a friend turns against us. But note, please, that Jesus endured that to an extent greater than any of us will ever endure it. And he still treated Judas like a friend. Secondly, Judas's deed is inconceivable and incomprehensible to Jesus' disciples. One of the fascinating human interest angles to the Last Supper, and there are many, is that none of the disciples suspect Judas to be the traitor. When Jesus tells them that one of them would betray him, not one of those disciples say, "I think I know who it is. It's that Judas. I've been suspicious of him since the day he joined us." Not one said that. In fact, every one of them said, "Lord, is it I? Lord, is it I?" Each one suspects himself before he suspects Judas. In fact, the disciples don't even believe it's Judas after Jesus clearly identifies it as Judas. If you begin reading in verse 22 here, just after Jesus plainly tells them that one would betray him, it says his disciples stared at one another at a loss to know which of them he meant. One of them, the disciple whom Jesus loved, was reclining next to him. Simon Peter motioned to this disciple and said, "Ask him which one he means." And leaning back against Jesus, he asked him, "Lord, who is it?" Now, it's important to grasp the setting here. In ancient times, a table was very low. Instead of sitting around it on chairs, people would recline around the table, usually leaning on their left elbow so their right hand would be free to eat, with their legs stretched out in front of them. Apparently, although we're not absolutely certain, Jesus sat at the head of a U-shaped table, or he reclined there, with John, his beloved disciple, on his right, and Judas in the place of honor at his left, and Peter probably next to Judas. So Peter was across the table from John. And Peter uses sign language to get John's attention and whispers to him, "Ask Jesus who it is that's going to betray him." And we read that John asks, "Lord, who is it?" And Jesus answers, "It is the one to whom I will give this piece of bread when I have dipped it in the dish." Then dipping the piece of bread, he gave it to Judas Iscariot, son of Simon. As soon as Judas took the bread, Satan entered into him. And Jesus said, "What you are about to do, do quickly." Now here's the amazing thing, verse 28. It says, "But no one at the meal understood why Jesus said this to him." Some of them thought Judas was leaving in order to buy some food. Others thought Judas was leaving in order to give alms to the poor, but they find it inconceivable that Judas is the betrayer. After all, isn't he their trusted treasurer? Isn't he destined to become the chancellor of the exchequer in the kingdom? They cannot grasp that this Judean, the only Judean among them, the most cultured, the most educated of the disciples, could betray the Lord. This one who had walked with them for 3.5 years, who had healed the sick, who had cast out demons, who had preached the gospel. They are more sure of him than they are of themselves. There's a lesson here for all of us. And I don't think it's the lesson that we should be suspicious of everyone around us. But rather, a lesson is that we must not put our ultimate confidence in people. People will fail us. Even a trusted servant of God will sometimes fail, turn out to be a phony. Our confidence must be in the Lord. Now, thirdly, we note that Judas's deed is memorialized in infamy. There is no one in all of human history whose character and actions are remembered with greater disdain than that of Judas. Mothers still on occasion name their children Adolf or Benedict, even though Hitler and Benedict Arnold sullied those names in a terrible way. But no mother would name her child Judas. Jesus said of Judas one of the most tragic things that was ever said of a human being. It would have been better for that man if he had never been born. It would have been good for that man because this man's heart became a home for Satan himself. There are many people in the scriptures who are said to be demon-possessed, but who other than Judas is said to have been Satan-possessed? The portion of our text that deals with Judas ends with this observation, and as soon as Judas had taken the bread, he went out, and it was night. But as soon as Judas leaves, it's as though a light was turned on. The little group has been purged of its evil element. And Jesus seems to have the freedom now to speak openly of a very important subject to his disciples. In fact, for the next 4 chapters, he delivers the upper room discourse where he speaks very personally and very intimately with his disciples. Right here in verses 31 to 35, Jesus offers just a preview of that upper room discourse. Allow me to read it. When he was gone, Jesus said, "Now is the Son of Man glorified, and God is glorified in him. If God is glorified in him, God will glorify the Son in himself and will glorify him at once. My children, I will be with you only a little longer. You will look for me, and just as I told the Jews, so I tell you now, where I am going, you cannot come. A new command I give you, love one another. As I have loved you, you must love one another. By this, all men will know that you are my disciples, if you love one another." Now, we do not have time this morning to exhaust this discourse. But one thing is clear. Jesus is about to leave his disciples, and he gives them a farewell gift. A gift in the form of a commandment that he calls a new commandment. Why is it new? After all, didn't Moses, 1,500 years before this, give a commandment very similar to this? He said, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and strength, and your neighbor as yourself." Yes, in fact, Jesus had quoted that verse many times during his earthly ministry. But this new commandment is new in that it is directed to one another, not just to one's neighbor. You see, if you look carefully at what Moses wrote, it becomes obvious that the neighbor there is any other Jew. But when Jesus commands us to love one another, there are no racial parameters there, no gender parameters, no class distinctions. We are to love every other individual who names the name of Christ. Secondly, this commandment is new in that it is measureless. The measure of love in the Old Testament was love as you love yourself. Love your neighbor as you love yourself. But here the measure is, as I have loved you, you also must love one another. Well, how did Jesus love? Really, in a measureless fashion. He loved sacrificially. He loved selflessly. He loved individually, not just corporately. I think there are times when we get into a mode of loving everybody in general, but nobody in particular. Well, Jesus didn't love like that. Furthermore, Jesus loved unconditionally. So often, our love is conditioned upon performance or popularity or likability. I must share a moving illustration that I read this week of unconditional love. A young man returned from the Vietnam War, and from San Francisco, he called his parents in a fashionable area of Boston. "Mom," he said, "I have a war buddy I'd like to bring home with me." "Sure, son," said his socialite mother. "But Mom, I want you to know that he has no right leg or right arm or right eye." "Well, son, it'll be okay to bring him home for a few days." "No, Mom, I want him to live with us permanently. He desperately needs the love and support of a family like ours." "Son, I'm afraid that just won't be possible. We simply don't have the time to take care of an invalid. But come home quickly. We're anxious to see you." A few hours later, a San Francisco police sergeant called that same Boston home. "Ma'am, we've a young man here who is missing an arm and a leg. His identification papers show that he's your son. He just took his life. I'm sorry." Her love was conditional, or at least he interpreted it that way. And that's not what he needed. When Jesus commanded us to love one another, he commanded us to love selflessly and sacrificially and individually and unconditionally. Thirdly, this new commandment is new in regard to the promise attached to it. "By this all men will know that you are my disciples, if you love one another." The promise is that the world will sit up and take notice if and when Christians love one another. In fact, I would go further and say that you would have to build a moat around the church to keep people out if Christians were loving one another as Jesus commands us to do. On the negative side, when Christians don't love one another, then almost no combination of beautiful facilities and great preaching and relevant programming and evangelistic technique will make any difference. By the way, this verse does not say that we become his disciples by loving one another. We become his disciples by faith. But rather, the world recognizes that we are Jesus' disciples when we love one another. That's the greatest evangelistic tool the church has in its arsenal, is loving one another. Well, it was night when Judas left, but then for a few moments the light shined on that little group as Jesus spoke of the need for love among them. And then the darkness closes in once again, as we are informed of the darkness of denial. Look at verses 36 to 38. Simon Peter asked him, "Lord, where are you going?" It's as though Peter hadn't heard anything Jesus said about this new commandment. He got stuck on the previous statement that I'm going somewhere and you can't come. "Lord, where are you going?" Jesus replied, "Where I am going, you cannot follow now, but you will follow later." Peter asked, "Lord, why can't I follow you now? I will lay down my life for you." Then Jesus answered, "Will you really lay down your life for me? I tell you the truth, before the rooster crows, you will disown me three times." Of all the four Gospels, John tells us the least amount about Peter's defection. But interestingly, he tells us the most about Peter's restoration afterwards. And I think the reason for that is these two men were part of the inner circle of three of Jesus' disciples, and they loved one another. And John wants to paint Peter in the best light possible. But if we look at the other Gospels, particularly the Gospel of Mark, what we find there are the steps to Peter's defection. And I want you to turn to Mark 14 with me. For in Mark 14, we will find that Peter boasts too much, he prays too little, he acts too soon, and he remembers too late. First of all, he boasts too much. A hint of Peter's boastfulness was spotted back there in John 13, but it's much more obvious in Mark 14, verses 29 to 31, where Peter responds to Jesus' warning that all of them would fall away by claiming, "Even if all fall away, I will not." And then when Jesus tells him that that very night, Peter himself would disown him three times, Peter insists emphatically, "Even if I have to die for you, I will never disown you." Now, just to be fair to Peter, it adds there, "And so all the others said the same." But Peter, in particular, boasted too much. Furthermore, he prayed too little. The setting of the next paragraph is in the Garden of Gethsemane, following the Last Supper. And as you recall, Jesus left eight of his disciples in one place in the garden, and he took the inner circle of three a little further on, and then he left them there to pray, and he went just a little bit further to pour out his heart to his Father. And in verse 37, we read, "He returned to the disciples and found them sleeping. 'Simon,' he said to Peter, 'are you asleep? Could you not keep watch for 1 hour? Watch and pray so that you will not fall into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the body is weak.' This happened three times." Peter not only boasted too much, he also prayed too little. And then we see, thirdly, that he acted too soon. Shortly after Jesus finds the disciples sleeping for the third time, Judas arrives with the Lord's enemies in tow. And he kisses Jesus as a sign so that they won't arrest the wrong man in the dark. And as they seize Jesus, we read in verse 47, "Then one of those standing near drew his sword and struck the servant of the high priest, cutting off his ear." Now, Mark doesn't tell us who that individual was, nor does Matthew, nor does Luke. But in John 18, we are told that the one who drew his sword was Peter. Howie Hendricks, from whom I borrowed part of this outline, said Peter, being a fisherman, was a bad swordsman. He really meant to hit the crease in that servant's helmet and split his head open, but he missed and just got his ear, which Jesus, of course, put back on and healed. Jesus chides Peter for using physical weapons in a spiritual battle. Finally, Peter remembers too late. After Jesus is arrested, Peter follows him incognito into the courtyard of the high priest, and he watches from a distance as he warms himself by the fire as Jesus undergoes a kangaroo court. Then a little servant girl of the high priest comes by and studies his face and asks, "You were with that Nazarene, weren't you?" And Peter denies it. But she doesn't give up. She says to some other people standing around that Peter is one of them. This fellow is one of them. And Peter vehemently denied it. And then some of the people standing around said, "Your accent gives you away. You are a Galilean. You are one of his." And it says that Peter began to call curses down on himself. And he swore to them, "I don't know this man you're talking about." And immediately the text says, the rooster crowed the second time. Then Peter remembered the word Jesus had spoken to him. And he broke down and wept. Friends, those four tendencies that led to Peter's defection are real dangers for us as well. Boastfulness, prayerlessness, impulsiveness, and forgetfulness. Boastfulness. How easy it is to verbalize a commitment, but the self-confidence and the pride that produce such boastfulness vanish when the heat is on. That is why Paul wrote, "God forbid that I should boast except in the cross of Christ my God." Prayerlessness. I don't know about you, but I can relate to Peter being unable to pray for a solid hour late at night. In fact, I understand the difficulty of praying for a half hour in broad daylight. I have to fight for prayer time. It is a spiritual battle, a never-ending spiritual battle to spend time in prayer. But it's a battle that we cannot afford to abandon. Prayer is so critical to our spiritual well-being. It is so critical to the health of our families. It's so critical to our ministry as a church. It's so critical to the moral fabric of our nation. This Thursday is our National Day of Prayer. Sometimes I fear that we evangelicals who are proud that we believe in prayer beyond the belief of the liberals may spend less time praying for our nation than they do. This Thursday is an opportunity for us to pray earnestly for our nation, our church, our families. The church is going to be open all day Thursday for prayer. We'll have a corporate prayer meeting at 6:30, an hour in the morning, 6:30 to 7:30, and another one 11:30 to 12:30. Then we invite you to join with Christians all over the city at Memorial Presbyterian Church down on Skinker across from Forest Park for a citywide concert of prayer. We need to be in prayer, much prayer, so that we too do not fall into temptation. Then there's impulsiveness, often a byproduct, I think, of boastfulness and prayerlessness. When we get it in our heads that we have it all together and we fail to take God into account as we are making major decisions, we invariably end up doing our own thing by our own timetable, and disaster is just a short way off. And then there's forgetfulness. The word remember is a very common word in the Bible because forgetfulness is a very common problem. If we would hide the word of God in our hearts and call it to mind before it's too late, the difficulty we would spare ourselves is incalculable. Now, there are three important principles that I want us to share in conclusion that come out of this passage. First, self-confidence can be too strong. We tend today to view self-confidence as an asset to one's personality. And I think that generally speaking, it is exactly that. But self-confidence can be a liability, especially when the self part of it is dominant. The scriptures say in 1 Corinthians 10:12, "Let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall." Friends, if someone can walk with Jesus for 3.5 years, hear all his discourses firsthand, see all of his miracles with his own eyes, and still betray him within minutes after being warned that he would do so, or still deny him within minutes after being warned that he would do so, then any one of us can fall. What we all need is a humble sense of dependency upon God to keep us from falling. This also leads me to suggest that we shouldn't be too surprised when professing Christians turn out to be phonies and when real Christians fail. I simply don't get bothered in it anymore when I hear the excuse from some people that they have not become a Christian because there are so many hypocrites and phonies in the church. I simply respond, so what? After all, among Jesus' chosen disciples, one was a phony and one was a hypocrite. That's 16 2/3%. I wouldn't expect any lesser percent in any church today. I'm not trying to minimize the awfulness of betrayal or denial, but I am trying to say that these are not good excuses for lack of commitment. When we stand in judgment before God and are asked what we have done with Jesus Christ or what we have done for Jesus Christ, God is not going to be impressed with any excuse regarding phonies or hypocrites in the church. We need to get our eyes off of other people anyway and give attention to whether we ourselves are in the faith. The second principle that I find here is that remorse can come too late. You know, it did for Judas and it did for Peter. The scriptures tell us in Matthew 27 this about Judas's final end. It says, when Judas, who had betrayed him, saw that Jesus was condemned, he was seized with remorse and returned the 30 silver coins to the chief priests and the elders. I have sinned, he said, for I have betrayed innocent blood. What is that to us? They replied. That's your problem. So Judas threw the money into the temple and left. Then he went away and hanged himself. In Peter's case, after he heard the rooster crow, he remembered the word of the Lord and he broke down and wept. Both men felt remorse. For both, it was too late to reverse their actions. For Judas, the die had been cast and his eternal destiny was sealed. For Peter, there was still hope. For while his action could not be reversed, his heart was still warm to Christ and he was able to receive Christ's forgiveness. One can even see the contrast between the hopelessness of Judas's failure and the hope that is still left, though Peter has failed, when you look at the phrases that come in John 13 after each failure. Right after Judas fails, the text says, and it was night. The next statement after Peter's failure is this: do not let your hearts be troubled. Trust in God. Trust also in me. The final truth I'd like to offer is that one cannot find a better friend than Jesus. Who other than Jesus would have taken such great pains to warn Judas and to call him back to himself? Who would have given him the place of honor at the Last Supper? Who would have refused to expose him to his colleagues? And who other than Jesus would have readily forgiven Peter and made him one of the founders of his church? No one, I think, other than Jesus himself. The hymn states, there's not a friend like the lowly Jesus. No, not one. No, not one. And then it asks this question: did ever saint find this friend forsake him? Or sinner find that he would not take him? No, not one. No, not one. Jesus offers satisfaction, not suicide. He offers reward, not remorse. He offers light, not night. Bow with me, will you, in prayer. Father, we have been warned today about betrayal, and we've been warned about denial. Help us, Father, not to be boastful and prayerless and impulsive. Help us, Father, not to be filled with remorse because we remembered your word too late. I pray that you would speak to each one of us at our point of need through this, your holy word. In Jesus' name.